Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, in early 2009, shortly after the emergence of Twitter, I did a show with a couple of young tech enthusiasts called Social Media, For Good or Evil. And we talked about the pros and cons of social media and the internet in general, for people individually and for society broadly. So being an old guy who remembered a time, and that was 2009, right? Before the internet and social media, I voted that it was a negative for society. And they didn't agree, of course. I was outvoted. In fact, I knew it would be that way before I even started the show. At that time, websites and email were already well established, but Facebook was still pretty new, and Snapchat and Instagram had not even yet been thought of. Obviously, the influence of social media has greatly increased since then. It seems to dominate the lives of many Americans to what is, to me at least, an alarming degree. And recently, Facebook found itself at the center of a major controversy because the data it collects on its users were mined or scraped by an app developer and then sold to a company that used them to create online political advertising aimed at those users in a tailored way that might have influenced the presidential election in 2016, and at the very least intensified the political divisions that are so apparent in our society today. My guest is Dr. Sherry Hamby, a professor of psychology at the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee. She's director of the Life Paths Appalachian Research Center there. So I ran across some research she did that was published recently on the interactions of rural Appalachian people with social media and technology in general, and how it differs culturally from that of urban and more maybe tech-savvy Americans. Our flagship station here is WETS in Northeast Tennessee, and we're right on the edge of Appalachia, and I thought that would be an interesting topic to explore. This was in an article on how people who don't use Facebook at all don't have to worry that they're among the 87 million people whose personal information was being used without their knowledge. Welcome, Dr. Hamby.
Thank you for having me.
Can we call you Sherry?
Absolutely.
So why don't you plunge in and tell us about your research and what you found?
Sure. There are not a lot of studies on technology use that really look at the experience of people in rural communities, or if there are those kinds of studies, they tend to be through this very deficit-based lens where they just kind of assume that because of lack of access or lack of low income and inability to pay for things, that people are using technology as much as they can possibly access given their circumstance, but they don't really explore how people in these kinds of communities think about technology or what ways that they are choosing to navigate or even resist technology.
So they go on kind of stereotypes and make simple assumptions based on that. So I was reading you studied 65 people, of whom a little over half were women from low socioeconomic status communities in rural Appalachia, and I guess all ages from preteen to elderly. How low economically were your study sample, and how rural were they?
We went out into this community to try to do some more open-ended types of research, so using focus groups and interviews. And we really went out into several different communities down here on the Cumberland Plateau, which is sort of the southernmost range of Appalachia. And it is pretty low income and pretty rural. We went into this particular study, one of the lowest income communities in Tennessee, and one that is pretty far away from, you know, any other major metropolitan area. These are small towns. Most of them are not more than 1,500 or 2,000 people, and they're pretty spaced out from each other. So, you know, it can be a little bit of a drive to even get from one of these small communities to the next. So we're talking pretty rural.
Did you get to places that were not even towns, but that were just kind of little settlements or even individual clusters of, I don't know, cabins or whatever way up in the hills and hollows? Or did you have to...
Well, I might be using the definition of a town differently than a lot of your, yeah, your listeners were. I mean, these are places that either don't have any stoplights at all, or maybe there's like one stoplight or one flashing light right in the middle of town at the biggest intersection. So, for example, we organize them around community events. We do a lot of them around festivals or other types of annual events in the communities, or sometimes we will go to clubs or organizations and go and recruit people through their monthly meeting. So we're not usually, you know, really outside of any kind of area where there would be you know, groups of people congregating.
Were these always places where there was internet access? Because that would obviously be important in terms of gauging their access to and use of technology. Did they always at least have a cell tower within range?
Well, when you say internet access around here, what you're more likely to get is some kind of Wi-Fi. And there are a lot of people around here who rely on the Wi-Fi that's offered by the local libraries or things like that. Cell phone towers are pretty newfangled things out here. There is still one community that doesn't have any cell phone tower access at all, and most of the rest of us have just gotten good cell phone tower service in the last 5 years or so. A lot of people do, you know, either at their schools or at their workplaces. I mean, it would be more common that you could use your smartphone through some Wi-Fi connection than using data.
Yeah, so your research was about, and we're going to talk about, the folks in these communities, their use of technology. But I would say that, you know, you started off saying that the better educated, higher income, urban, and generally more elitist Americans, I guess, tend to assume that rural and low-income people don't use technology mainly because they can't afford it because they're low-income. But I think it's partly another factor is their access to technology is more restricted than those more elitist people. Wouldn't you say that's true?
Well, I mean, I would say that that's true to a certain extent, but I also think that one of the things that surprised us the most about our study was how many people were really actively resisting the creep of modern technology. And so, you know, these days in 2018, it's not so much a matter that you can't get a signal for your phone or that you can't go somewhere where you could get onto, you know, free Wi-Fi at a, like I said, at a school or a library or a restaurant or something like that. But there were still a lot of people who really were resisting technology and were deeply suspicious about whether or not this was really improving the people's lives who had adopted it and embraced it more fully.
Yeah, that was kind of the core of your study. I mean, I'm quoting from the abstract here. It said, participants reported ways of both resisting and navigating technology, many of which were deeply grounded in core Appalachian values such as respect for privacy. Participants reported numerous strategies for navigating technology risks. So that's really, you know, especially in the context of this whole Facebook debacle that occurred recently, what are some of those strategies that these folks use, and what are some of the Appalachian values, such as respect for privacy, that kind of lead them to handle technology differently? And so it's not an issue of cost or access, but an issue of attitudes toward technology. That's what we really want to get at here. What are some of those strategies?
Well, a lot of them were certainly expressing their feelings of resistance with a sense of humor. You know, like one woman's like, well, I don't want anything that's smarter than I am. But she also was clear that she just felt like she had all she needed she did have a phone, but she didn't want to adopt a smartphone. There were a lot of people, even the very youngest people in our sample, we had adolescents as young as age 12 who were expressing burnout, I think, with how many selfies their fellow students were posting on Instagram or Snapchat and, you know, just joking around with like, you know, seriously, I don't need like more selfies of you. I just saw you like 5 minutes ago in school, you know, people making fun of the way, I mean, on our campus here, for example, it's become a little bit of a joke, too, about the way that people will text each other or message each other on Facebook or something like that when they're literally, you know, just two doors down the hall in the exact same dorm. But we heard that out in the community, even in other settings, too. So people were just like, why is my neighbor, you know, texting me or messaging me when they could just really go outside and get my attention that way or come on over and feeling that sense of loss about how depersonalized a lot of our interactions have become even in close proximity.
Yeah, I think that's important. And I think that's a major factor. I mean, as I said, I live in Northeast Tennessee on the edge of Appalachia. And, you know, I see a lot of local people using Facebook, but I think also that people here, I notice, really like to talk. I mean, they talk, they visit more. I think it's part of the culture. They visit more, and they'll stand in the street if they bump into each other and talk. And I'm constantly trying to edge away because I've always got something to do. But the talking and connecting seems to be a bigger priority here than I'm used to in other places that I've lived, you know, along the coast and big cities and in Florida. And I think that the technologies, as you just said, are kind of a barrier to that personal interaction. I mean, almost exactly like you said, I remember 10 years ago when texting was, you know, getting really prevalent among younger kids, going out to dinner with my in-laws and my wife, and my nephew had brought a friend of his along, and they were literally sitting next to each other texting. And I asked him, who are you texting? And they looked at each other and said, him. You know, and I said, you're sitting 2 feet apart. Why are you texting? Well, I think part of it was so that they didn't have to talk to each other in front of us, maybe. But also, I think it's just part of their culture that they immediately adopted to do that. And it's so disconnected. So I think there's maybe, I don't know, see what you think about this. But my guess is that maybe in this culture in Appalachia, where visiting and chatting is so much more important, and there was so much more time, in a sense, than in the hurry-up city world, that people resent that disconnection, maybe. Do you feel like there's something to that?
Oh, I would absolutely agree that that's where a lot of people are coming from. And I think more and more research is starting to back up their sort of instinctual rejection of that depersonalized, disconnected way of communicating, as you were saying, and that now we know that heavy social media use and heavy online use are associated with increased symptoms of depression, increased feelings of alienation, even increased suicidality, I think, in some of these studies. So I do think that there's a loss, and there are a lot of things, I mean, perhaps not entirely specific to Appalachian culture, but to any culture. A lot of the culture is in the voice, it's in the dialect, it's in the facial expressions and the hand gestures and all of these things that really only get expressed and come to life when you are having face-to-face interaction. And then in text, you know, it just becomes so homogeneous, and so all the culture just gets tossed out the window when somebody's just, you know, typing, you know, are you there, or just always using like the absolutely briefest form of communication. All that sense of culture and community just goes right out the window with so many of those forms of communication.
Yeah, it's just flat. It's two-dimensional compared to the very three-dimensional mode of being there, you know, in front of somebody and talking. So that's definitely true. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Sherry Hamby, a psychologist at the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee, who is an expert on the ways people interact and has recently done some research on Appalachia and people in Appalachia and how they interact with technologies, in particular social media platforms. So another thing that you said in your study, and I'll read this part again, was many participants were skeptical of the value of technology and expressed regrets about the loss of self-reliance due to technology. So that's a kind of another factor that's different from the loss of connection. But I have to admit, I'm actually the same way. I mean, I have a Facebook account. I use only occasionally to look up someone I'm considering hiring in the company that I run, and I never post on it. I have several Twitter accounts in my name, my company name, and the radio show's name. But I've never tweeted one tweet. I mean, even the word sounds demeaning to me even. And I have them only to keep someone else from co-opting them and using them, right? So I basically see these, in one part, I see these as gigantic time wasters and also as personally demeaning, kind of trivializing your life. Because I really don't care if you just went to Walmart, and I also don't think you should care if I just went to Walmart. I mean, all that is just so minor that it debases someone's dignity in a way. And that's part of what I was getting at back in 2009 and the social media for good or evil thing. And I feel like that today as well. So, you know, you studied some of that self-reliance aspect of this. So why don't you talk about that, Sherry?
Sure. So self-reliance is a really important value in Appalachian culture. And really, if you just even wanted to pull out one single trait that you have probably are most typically valued and esteemed in Appalachian culture, I would probably name self-reliance as right up there. And it was even a little bit surprising to me, some of the forms of regret that people express. Like one woman, for example, said that she thought it was a shame the way that people use cell phones. Every time their car broke down, they would just call for help or call for a repairman. And she thought that that reflected a loss of self-reliance because back in the day, everybody would know how to change their own tire or maybe even do, you know, some other minor repairs and without having to get professional help for that. And so that, for example, was surprising to me because out of all of the things that people often say that this technology is good for, you know, being able to access help and in some situation like that has always been one of the first ones that people use to justify it. And so I was surprised that even that to her was like a loss of self-reliance. And, you know, and again, I think just this sense of being able to do things on your own, to not necessarily have to have an audience or approval for just basic things of the day, that they felt that was some sort of net loss in terms of the way that people were thinking about themselves and thinking about what they should be able to do for themselves.
I mean, I'm old enough to remember the 50s, for example. You know, I can remember, and I have a good memory, so I can remember the way people were 50, 60 years ago, and they were more themselves. I don't know, in some way, people were more maybe idiosyncratic a lot, or if they were eccentric, they were more eccentric or whatever. But I mean, people were more, had more a deeper sense of their own personality and character, I think, a long time ago than they do now. And it seems to me, this is going to sound a little odd, but they were gradually and even more rapidly nowadays edging toward a kind of a herd mentality where there's much greater homogeneity among people than there used to be. And there's a greater urge toward that and an urge toward conformity and less of an acceptance of difference, unless you kind of idealize difference in some way, which is kind of a fakey version of that. I don't know, I'm getting a little complicated here, I guess. But it seems to me that the social media in particular push people toward being connected in ways that are too connected, almost hive-like or herd-like, you know, and I think that maybe the Appalachian culture, where two generations back, people were way up in the hills and isolated and never ventured more than 10 to 15 miles from their home in their whole lives in some cases, led them to a greater self-reliance that this kind of tendency offends. That's the complicated way of getting at what I was trying to say. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that like a lot of things, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. I mean, there are certainly some things that I think are better than they were in the 50s and 60s. And in some ways, I think that we are more tolerant of wider ranges of ways of being in the world. But I do also agree that there's this level of self-consciousness that social media have brought in. You know, I mean, for myself, I think about it. I mean, it's nice to have ways to kind of keep up with people. You're right, the young people don't use it very much. But a lot of my students now sort of use that as a way to make announcements. Like this time of year, I can see several students who graduated from Sewanee 2 or 3 years ago or getting their master's or their law degrees, and they're posting that, or they post a lot of announcements of engagements. And those, I think, are nice. You know, it's kind of nice to, oh, look, you know, so-and-so's gotten engaged, or, you know, and so I think that's, we haven't really figured out how to balance that and how to not let that be a substitute for these real life relationships. That part concerns me personally the most, is that that people are not maintaining their closer, you know, the ones in their closer proximity. And I think that's what the concern of a lot of the people in our study were too, is that how is this affecting local community and local ties? You know, there's this also this issue about how much time it's wasting and taking up and how much we're taking a productivity hit, not just even in the workplace, but, you know, in all of our other work, when we just go down, it's so easy to go down that rabbit hole. And then you look up and you're like, oh, 2 hours have passed. And all you've been doing is kind of scrolling down your Facebook feed. And that, I think, we're just only starting to wrestle with what the impact of that has been.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mean to say that this is all bad, but, and that was kind of the premise of that show I did, back in 2009, that it's pros and cons. And for all of these things, there are positive and there are negative aspects to it. And it's basically in your own experience and your own set of attitudes, how you weight the positives and the negatives and which one comes out being heavier, right? Which one wins. And so to me, I think it was pretty clear that a lot of the, especially the social media the negative aspects outweighed the positive. I mean, when you look at the forms of evil that are generated by it nowadays that were never even possible in a way before because the people who had certain inclinations, whether it was, you know, child molestation or child pornography or whatever it might be, were isolated and thought they were strange because they were the only person they knew with those thoughts and they kept them to themselves. Now they have an online community that empowers them to do that and gives them the tools to proceed with it. And, you know, gosh, I mean, the people who FaceTime watching some disaster happen when they could be helping people involved in that disaster, those kinds of things that we see, going on. But there's a kind of a disconnect. Again, that's a function of the disconnectedness that people feel. Like it takes you away from the feeling of immediacy and reality of what's going on around you and puts you in a mode of, I have to capture this and then broadcast it. You know, I'm an observer, right? So,
yes, I think that there are things that probably none of us really fully appreciated about the filters that used to be applied to some kinds of information. And when it was, you know, three networks and, you know, your local hometown newspaper, there were a lot of people who were making judgments about what kinds of things were not in the public interest. And I mean, of course, those judgments were never perfect. Sometimes they were not covering things that they should have been covering. But yeah, on balance, I think that probably seems the case right now, at least, that they may have been right more often than they were wrong, and that having somebody apply some kind of filter is, you know, I mean, these live Facebook, I just think I don't understand how that's even being allowed to continue going when it's been used to broadcast some just horrifying things, you know, suicides and assaults and these other more minor things, but still destructive ones, like drug use. And it's not that it's bad to have some sort of record of that, but I just worry that I have two teenagers and their content that they're getting access to is just not filtered in a way that it was when we were young.
You know, and this again is all in the general context of connectedness and being connected and or disconnected. And you know, I seem to be more anecdotal in this show than I normally am. But a few days ago, I was arranging or organizing a local event. And in the course of that, was talking with an older guy in his 70s who was born, I think, in 1945. And he was telling me he's a wood carver, right? He's a real Appalachian person, you know. And he was telling me he was born, you know, way back in the hills, in 1945. And they didn't have electricity. And when they got electricity, he was about 10 or 12 by the time they got electricity. And how happy that made them. And I asked him, were you happy before that? And he said, oh, yeah, we were perfectly happy, but we didn't know what we were missing. But we were real happy once we got it. And I said, yeah, I bet your mother in particular really was, because it made life easier for her. But I asked him whether the phone that I had called him on was a landline or a cell phone, because I'd need to get in touch with him later. And he said, well, it's a cell phone. That's all I have. And I just have an old flip phone, and it can't do much. But then again, I don't need to know that much about the world, and the world doesn't need to know that much about me. It kind of encapsulates a lot of what we're talking about, in that he, in his whole life, has been more self-reliant and doesn't need to be connected to the herd, right? It's not a need he has, and in fact, it kind of makes him uncomfortable to be. So, but he's 73 years old or whatever, and I think that attitude is dying out, but I hope it won't die out entirely, because there's a value to that for us as humans, right?
Yes, I think stories like that were ones that we heard from a lot of people around here. That does definitely encapsulated. And I think it touches on another Appalachian value of humility, which is still a pretty core Appalachian value. I don't think it's completely dying out. We heard threads of it from a lot of our adolescents as much as we did from a lot of our older people. And, you know, there are fewer social ills that are greater than putting on airs in Appalachian culture. And, you know, social media just by its nature kind of flies in the face against that. And so I think that's one of the reasons why people here, another reason why they're skeptical of it, is they just are more in touch with that sense of humility than you see in at least mainstream U.S. culture. I don't think they, you know, I don't think Appalachia has a exclusive handle on any of self-reliance or humility or self-deprecating humor or anything like that. But I think it's something that they still value those traits here in ways that you don't see on like mainstream television or media so much anymore.
Or in cities. Yeah, I definitely agree. I see that here. Let me give just a couple of stats to kind of put this whole thing about social media in context, I mean, you know, I looked this up. Everybody's an instant expert on Wikipedia, right? But worldwide, in the first quarter of 2018, there were 2.2 billion monthly active Facebook users, which is nearly a third of all the people on Earth. And that includes infants and 2-year-olds and people living in third world countries where there's no internet access. I mean, that's nearly a third of all people. And that compares to only 330 million monthly users of Twitter worldwide, which is a lot less than Facebook, but it's still nearly as many people as the entire population of the U.S. So of the roughly 280 million Americans over the age of 13, 213 million of them, that's nearly two-thirds, are on Facebook. So nearly two-thirds of all Americans are on Facebook.
Now, I was just going to say, so what you see here in Appalachia is what I really would call is like just more variability compared to that. So, yeah, there are some things like Facebook or at least some sort of social media. Smartphone use is pushing into like 90% of the population in the United States. Emails, things like that. And so there are tons of people in these communities who are very high technology users and would just follow that kind of typical pattern in any way. And, you know, on that end, we heard a lot of people talking about worries about being addicted to their phone and, you know, the kinds of things that are getting a lot of attention now. But I think what you see in this community is that there's just a lot more people who are not necessarily doing just the sort of high adopter, go out and get it, sign up right away kind of approach that is what we see represented again in the media most often. But some who are picking and choosing a lot more intentionally. We did a quantitative survey that followed up on the qualitative study we've been talking about. And about 1 in 4 people in this community were what we would call light technology users that were didn't have any technology or would use computers and phones and things like that. They said cell phones and things like that. They said they use them less than once a week. I think what people hear, again, they kind of want to go for the stereotypes and they think, they know nobody here knows how to use a smartphone or nobody here has a computer. And that's not really true. But what you do see here, I think, compared to what you would see in, you know, Manhattan or Atlanta or even maybe like Knoxville or somewhere like that, is that you just see a lot more variability in terms of people picking and choosing which of these types of technology or social media they want to interact with.
Sherry, we're just about out of time, but I'm going to kind of speculate briefly here and think that maybe this recent Facebook scandal has caused a kind of awakening. I mean, there are new terms that you hadn't heard before, like Facebook shunner and social media abstainer. And maybe there seems to be a dawning awareness that using social media can hurt you in some ways. Is this maybe a trend that starts at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder and works its way up? I mean, the opposite of the usual direction. What do you think, just briefly?
Yeah, I think that there are lots of pockets of people who are still resisting these technologies and that they may well, you know, lead the way for the rest of us who are trying to unplug a little bit more and resist some of the addictive nature of these technologies.
Well, good. I hope so. And that would be a good thing, I think. So, Dr. Sherry Hamby, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, it's been interesting. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.